Colossians 2:18 through 3:4. The ninth talk in a series on Colossians was presented by Ron Julian on September 12, 1999 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1999. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
Okay. We're continuing on in Colossians this morning. I'm always told that I'm not supposed to say this sort of stuff, but I will anyway. I'm really tired. I'm not supposed to apologize. I'm always been told that I apologize too much. But the fact is, we've been working really hard this week, part of this birthday stuff and all kinds of things, and I cannot think. My mind is a total blank. If this makes even less sense than usual today, just hang on and at the end ask Jack questions, and it'll all be clear. What we've been seeing so far, we're in chapter 2 of Colossians, heading towards chapter 3, and we've started to look at that part of the letter that is a strong exhortation to the people that he's writing to. You'll remember that the situation is sort of dicey in Colossae. On the one hand, he's genuinely grateful for the signs of real faith and repentance that he's seen among them. And yet on the other hand, at the same time, there is some sort of strange teaching that has grown up among them, something having to do with a certain kind of religious asceticism. You know, there are rules, you need to not eat these things and celebrate these festivals and so on, that somehow the essence of spirituality is to be found in these ritualistic requirements. And Paul sees the teaching. We're trying to sort of put together a picture of what it was exactly that was going on there. And it's difficult to be precise about what the Colossians were listening to. But it's serious enough that Paul sees it really as an alternative to the gospel. I mean, he's urging them to hold fast. There's a prize awaiting for them. There is an inheritance that's theirs if they hold fast. And he's worried that some of them are not. So he has been saying to them, hold fast to the teachings about Christ that you first believed. You heard the gospel more or less as I proclaim it, Paul, through the teaching of Epaphras and others. There were ideas there. There were truths about who Jesus is and who you are and what salvation is and what you need to do. There's a set of ideas there that you need to hold fast to. Don't be suckered into abandoning the truth about Christ for something else, which he sees as really it's an alternative that has been cooked up by men. It makes a lot of sense in a worldly sort of way, as we're going to see, but it doesn't fit reality. It's not the way things really are. You need to hold fast to Christ because he's the center of everything. Everything is happening with him. You can't go someplace else to find truth and life and fulfillment because it's all to be found in him. That's what he's been saying. He is the source of everything that you need. He is the ruler above all rulers. There's nobody that comes along and overrules him and says, no, he missed it here. You need to do some of this stuff. You have a problem, and his death on the cross is the only solution to be found. It's not one solution among many. It is the solution. And as he's been emphasizing, whether you know it or not, what you really need as a human being is reconciliation with God. The problem of your guilt needs to be solved. And there's only one way to solve it, and that's Christ's offering of himself on the cross. And when, then, I'm reconciled to God, then the possibility of renewal is there. Now I am one with God. He and I are together again. My guilt is not separating us, and so I have an inheritance. I am his child, and I stand to inherit all that he wants his children to inherit. And foremost among those things that I inherit is life, eternal life, and more importantly, life lived with the problem of corruption gone. The corruption of death, moral corruption, everything that is sapping away the life out of life now, that's what Jesus came to repair. He came to rescue me, and I need rescuing. That's what Paul has been trying to get across to them, is that's the only place to go. In Christ, you have the real deal. This is what the whole story has been about, what Christ came to do for us. And if you start listening to this other stuff, you're walking away from the real thing and embracing the shadows again. The rituals of religion have a certain place, but they're not the heart of it. They're not what it's about. And by turning to a message that says true spirituality is to be found in keeping these rules and eating these foods and not eating these foods and restricting yourself and disciplining your body in these ways. This is what spirituality is all about. This is what you do to be acceptable to God. You have walked away from the only way to be acceptable to God, which is to humbly admit that you are a sinner and seek the mercy that is available at the cross of Christ. You have abandoned that for something that is going to get you nowhere. That's what he's been saying. So, let's pick up then in verse 18. Let no one keep defrauding you of your prize by delighting in self-abasement and the worship of angels, taking his stand on visions he has seen, inflated without cause by his fleshly mind. Okay, now let me just say right off that I'm going to speak in very general terms about what we find in this verse. And the reason is because this is incredibly obscure Greek that's going on here. There are all these questions, one after another, as you go through it. And I don't want to bog us down with going through each of these little details and trying to sort out what each of them. I mean, you end up with this flow chart. If this means this, then this might mean this or this, and it gets very, very complicated. Let me just sort of back up and give you what I think we can see in general is going on here. First of all, there is this idea, as he spoke of earlier, there are these who are preying on them. They're seeking them as a prize. They're looking to capture them to their own particular way of thinking and doing things. But he's saying if you let them do that, they're hoodwinking you. They're defrauding you. They're taking something from you that is valuable and essential. What Christ has done, as we've been talking about, is the focus of all creation. It's like you've been wandering in the desert all your life, and you've finally come across the one pool of water to be found in the entire desert. And now somebody is calling you over to this mirage and say, look, this is great. Come over here. You really like this. Say, don't let that happen. Now, what is it that he has to say in particular about the foolish person that is trying to defraud them here? How is he describing him? Let me just say that as I try to put the pieces together, I see ideas like this. This person is willful, headstrong, conceited without cause to be, very much convinced by his own ideas. This is not a person who really knows God. Now, we're talking about people who have set themselves up as religious leaders, people who are guides to those in Colossae, telling them, this is what you need to do This is how you become spiritual. This is how you arrive at piety. But in fact, these are people who are self-deceived. They have got this idea that the humiliation of the body, the abasement of the body, shows spirituality at its height. I'm going to limit myself. I'm going to take days where I don't do certain things, and I'm not going to eat certain foods, and I'm not going to drink certain drinks. You look around at the world around you, and there are all these people who feel free to eat what they want and drink what they want. That's not me. You can tell that I'm spiritual, because while they're up at the trough feeding on whatever they want, I'm back here abstaining. That's how you can tell that I'm a godly person. That's the kind of person that he's describing here and goes on to describe, I think. So although some of the details are sort of fuzzy, the picture in general, I think, is this idea of this self-willed, self-centered religious guide who in fact doesn't understand what's going on. And the key charge against him is what he goes on to say, and not holding fast to the head, from whom the entire body, being supported and held together by the joints and ligaments, grows with a growth which is from God. Now, so the problem here is this person, self-deceived, self-deluded, headstrong, convinced that he's got everything scoped out and he knows what it is that the religious life ought to look like. In fact, this person is not holding fast to the head. And he goes on to paint this picture of the people of God as parts of a body. That the church of God, the congregation of all those that belong to God, are like one big body with Christ as the head and being supported and held together by the joints and ligaments. That's the picture that he paints. Now, what he's saying about these false teachers is they're not holding fast to this head. In other words, they're not a part of this body. What does he mean? What is it that they have done? The issue is here, I'm pretty convinced, as it has been throughout, the question of their doctrine, of their teaching, of the ideas that they embrace. How can he tell that they're not holding fast to the head? Because they're teaching a set of strange ideas that don't fit with the apostolic gospel. That's what Paul's been saying from the beginning. Remember, he painted this strong picture of his ministry and the sufferings he went through as a minister to proclaim this gospel. And the purpose of all his sufferings were to teach and encourage and ground people in the truth. And if they are grounded in that truth, then they have an inheritance and they have life. But they have to stay grounded in that truth or they have nothing. So here he's describing those who are in fact not grounded in the truth of the gospel. They're not really holding fast to Christ, the teaching about Christ, the teaching from Christ. He has told us what life is about. On the cross, he accomplished the salvation that is necessary. As a teacher, he has taught us what is necessary. His apostles bring that message and explain it to us. That's what holding fast to the head would look like. Now, I'm not sure, but I suspect, I'm intrigued by the fact that Paul goes to the trouble in this picture of the body to talk about this support provided by the joints and ligaments. What is that all about? Why is that in there? Why does he say that? I mean, he could have just painted a simple picture of Christ is the head of this body of which we are members. But he seems to have called out in particular, implicit in his picture, there are the members, the various pieces, parts of the body. We are the various members, but it is supported and held together by the joints and ligaments. Why does he say that? Did he just get carried away and say, well, you know, bodies, they have joints and ligaments. Does that mean anything? No, but I just wanted to talk about it. I I always like that, you know, I love bending my elbow or something. I don't think so. I think he said it because, although he doesn't go on to draw the analogy, I think he is making some analogy that's implicit in what he's saying. That's what makes sense to me right now. And I wonder what it is. The thing that makes sense to me right now, if we picture the members as being held, supported and held together by the joints and ligaments, Christ is the head, there are the various members, and there is this, they are tied together by the joints and ligaments. The joints and ligaments seem to represent the way in which Christ, God, is bringing together, supporting, and tying this body together. So my suspicion is that it is something like, if there are the various members of the body, the joints and ligaments are those key elements that define us, that bring us together, that make us the body that we are. So I'm thinking that he's thinking something like the teaching of the apostles, that the apostles are the joints and ligaments, or the gospel, then the teachings of the gospels represent the joints and ligaments. Because the picture that he's trying to paint here is a set of teachers who have abandoned the truth about the gospel. They're fools. They're leading you astray. But those who hold fast to the head are a part of this body that is growing with a growth that is from God, and it is supported and held together by the joints and ligaments. So Christ is the head, and the apostolic teaching represents that which supports and brings the whole thing together. Now, maybe there's some other ideas you could think of as to what that picture might mean, and we can talk about that at the end. But something like that makes sense to me right now. If that's true, then that all of that is what the false teachers have cut themselves off from. In fact, there is this, in a sense, by analogy, this living organism. Its lifeblood is the teaching of the gospel, believing the gospel, holding fast to Christ, being taught by him and by his apostles, being forgiven through the life that he brings, through the offering of his body on the cross, being renewed through his life imparted to me. That's what happens to those who belong to God, who hold fast to the truth about Christ. All of that is what the false teachers have cut themselves off from. And that's what you will cut yourselves off from if you follow them. That's what he's saying. He goes on. If you have died with Christ to the elementary principles of the world, why, as if you were living in the world, do you submit yourself to decrees such as do not handle, do not taste, do not touch, which all refer to things destined to perish with the using, in accordance with the commandments and teachings of men? Now, I think, as I've been looking at this and trying to figure out what Paul's doing here, what makes sense to me in this and in the next couple of verses, what you need to have in mind is a contrast that Paul has between being focused on the things of this world versus being focused on the things of the next world. And being focused on the things of this world is bad, and being focused on the things of the next world is good. And he's going to kind of spell that out, what he has in mind. But that's the thing that's driving this. He's going to say we have died with Christ and we live with Christ. Well, in his analogy there, I have died with Christ to the things of this world, and I live with Christ, and my life is with him. So that's the picture that he wants to paint here. The problem with the teaching of the false teachers is it is worldly. And if we understand what that means, it is focused on this world. It is the kind of thing that a person does when he gets up. He looks around at the world. He knows nothing of God. He has turned away from God's own revelation of himself in Christ, and tries to figure out what is it that you got to do to be a godly, religious, pious person in this world. Well, I know. You need to discipline your body. You need to restrict yourself in accordance with religious rituals, and that self-denial will show your seriousness of purpose and will earn your place among the people of God. Well, no. The problem is that it makes a certain amount of sense in this world, but it is focused on the things of this world. Notice what Paul says. One of the things, a couple of the phrases I would call to your attention. He says, why as if you were living in the world? Well, of course, obviously I am living in the world in the sense. I mean, he doesn't mean that I'm not here, present, living in this world. But he's saying, in a sense, in my having died with Christ, I'm not living in this world anymore. My life is not about this world. I have come to see beyond it. I see where real life is to be found. I see what my existence is centered on. When you talk about what is the essence, what is the thing that I cannot do away with, that I cannot do without, take everything from me, but don't take this. Is that thing here in this world or in the next? Well, if I understand reality, that thing that I will not do away with, no matter what else goes, that is to be found in the next world. And we'll talk about what that means. But that's where it is to be found. It is in that sense, I think, Paul means we're not living in this world. I'm not living here with this world as my home, with this world as my focus, with this world as the place where my fulfillment must be found, and I must demonstrate my worthiness according to its rules. That's not the way I'm living anymore. Notice the other phrase that he uses. Do not handle, do not taste, do not touch, which all refer to things destined to perish with the using. Great. I have a rule, a religious rule. I don't eat meat, I eat only vegetables. So, today, I ate vegetables. And where are those vegetables now? They're gone. What do I have? I have a day where I ate vegetables, and it's gone. There's nothing eternal about it. There's nothing that lasts about it. Well, he's about to talk about my life hidden with Christ. What comes to me when Christ is revealed. The real life that is mine. That's the eternal stuff. That's the thing that lasts. But I'm not living in this world, and I'm not going to find the meaning of my existence by shuffling around the pieces of this world. You know, it's like I've been given the chess pieces, here's the board, and I can move them around whichever way you want, but I'm not going to find any combination that ends up being the meaning and purpose and focus of my life. If I do, I'm a fool. Because there's coming a time when a hand is going to come and sweep all the pieces off the board, and then what are you going to do? I mean, you got nothing. So, I think what Paul is getting at here is we have died with Christ to the elementary principles of the world, and we talked about this before, the elementary things, the kindergarten stuff. Even God himself had a place in the education of his people for fasting and religious rituals and Sabbaths and all of, you know, dietary restrictions and that sort of thing. They were for a purpose. They played a role. They were educational. They made us think about the seriousness of God's purposes and so on. But that's kindergarten stuff. That's the shadow pointing to the reality. And the reality is Christ. The reality is the reconciliation with God that he came to bring. The reality is the renewal of my soul, which he came to bring about. That's the reality. He's saying, in essence, my death with Christ, my looking to Christ's death on the cross, dying with him, and looking to be raised up with him, was a death to the elementary things of this world, because I've got the real thing. When I die with Christ, when I enter into all that His death means for me, now I find real reconciliation and real renewal, and there's no need for the shadows anymore. So because I have died with Him, because the shadows aren't important to me anymore, now I ought to be focusing on the real things, the solid things. And those are the things which are eternal. Those are the things which Christ is coming to bring at His return. Now, I do want to be careful here. Paul's logic is not any activity that is involved with something perishable has no innate moral value to it because it's just perishable, so do whatever you want. He's not saying that there are no moral issues regarding what I eat. He's not saying that there are no moral issues regarding what I do with my body. That's not what he means. In fact, we're going to see that the classic turnaround that Paul is going to make is, look, I want you to be focused entirely on the life to come. Therefore, you will live now in such a way. But it is that focus on the life to come which gives real wisdom, real perspective on the choices that I make now. He's not saying that there are not moral issues involved with what I eat, but he is saying that to say, limit what you eat in this way and you will prove yourself to be a spiritual person is foolishness. And it has no understanding of the eternal things. To say, oh, it's incredibly necessary that I keep this festival because it is in keeping this festival that I will arrive at true piety and righteousness is to misunderstand. It is when I understand what Christ came to do and what He is bringing me as my inheritance that now I start to understand the place of real righteousness. I can understand the nature of the decisions I face in this life, the ways in which I have to choose between the values of this world and the eternal values and that sort of thing. So there are very much real moral issues that I face with how I use my body. But what Paul is saying is they're leading you astray by setting up a set of ascetic rules that say, do this and you'll be righteous and spiritual. You'll be pious and godly. You have missed the point. As he is going to say next, these are matters which have to be sure the appearance of wisdom in self-made religion and self-abasement and severe treatment of the body, but are of no value against fleshly indulgence. This is not really accomplishing anything. Stay away from that meat. Don't drink this stuff. Don't work on these days. Go to this festival and pray instead of whatever else you might do. Limit yourself in that way, and you'll find real spirituality. He's saying, no, you won't. That doesn't really accomplish anything. You do all of that stuff, and what have you got? Have you really gotten at the heart of your problem? Have you gotten mastery over your flesh, over the evil that resides in you? No. You have disciplined your eating habits in a certain way, and that's all. Real change comes about in a very different way. Real change comes about by embracing the teaching of Christ, by being forgiven through His death on the cross, by entering into a new relationship with God whereby His Spirit is at work in me, bringing about new life. That's the way that real spiritual change is going to come about. So, yeah, you guys, it seems so wise. It looks so good. You know, I'm really impressed by that guy. You know, we all go out to the restaurant together, and he's sitting there with his little glass of water and some carrot sticks and stuff, and we're eating the Big Macs and everything, and oh man, that must be a really spiritual person. I mean, it seems like it. If you've ever been around somebody who takes religious ritual very seriously and take themselves very seriously because they engage in those rituals, you know how it can be very intimidating. It's like, you know, there are certain religious people in this world that when I get together with them, I feel like I'm a total pagan. I mean, they're so serious about this. You know, and it's like, am I even a believer? I mean, here I am. I didn't even think about it. And there's, well, I think that's what he's getting at, the appearance of wisdom. There's a certain appeal to that life. But what Paul's getting at is that's not the heart of it. You can do all of that stuff and intimidate people like crazy with your piety, but that's not really at the heart of it. So, what does he say? If then you have been raised up with Christ, keep seeking the things above, where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Set your mind on the things above, not on the things that are on earth. For you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is our life, is revealed, then you also will be revealed with him in glory. Well, see, again, before he talked about if you have died with Christ, and now he's saying if you have been raised up with Christ. This is all this picture that Jesus' death and resurrection is something that I, in some way, as we talked about before, have become identified with. His death is my death, and his life is my life. Well, I love the picture here. Set your mind on the things above, not on the things that are on earth, for you have died and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is our life, is revealed, then you also will be revealed with him in glory. There's a very real sense in which I am not living my own life yet. I mean, obviously, in a sense, I am. But I'm living in a world that is destined to perish. I'm living in a world that is corrupted with sin. I'm living in a world where it is not possible to put together a life that is totally fulfilling. I'm living in a world where death reigns. I'm living in a world where I myself am a sinner and I am my own worst enemy. This is not really life with a capital L. It is a life that has begun. I have been reconciled with God, and he is at work in me. As Paul is going to talk about, I am a new creation. There is a new life at work in me. And that's true. And I don't deny it for a minute. But Paul, even as he acknowledges that we're a new creation now, there's another very real sense in which I'm not living yet. My life is hidden with Christ. I died with him. His death brought about my reconciliation to God, and his life, his living presence, is going to bring to me everything that my life needs to be. I will be revealed with him. When he comes in glory and is revealed himself, and all the world sees who he is and what he's about, in a sense, you and I will be revealed. Finally, the world will see, and we will see, what we have been about. This is Ron Julian. You have known him, in a sense, but you haven't really known him, because you haven't known all that he's meant to be. But you'll know him then. His life will be revealed. Your life will be revealed, because Jesus is bringing your life with him. And what do we mean by all of that? Well, as I was saying, real life is to be found when this problem of death is solved, when the problem of sin is solved, when the problem of futility is solved. That's what Jesus is bringing with him. He's bringing glory to the world. This world will be a glorious place. I will be glorious. He will be glorious. All will be glorious. Well, if that's true, if all of the most important stuff about me is the stuff that Jesus is bringing with him, in a sense. He's bringing my resurrection from the dead. He's bringing my salvation from sin. He's bringing my eternal life. He's bringing his rule established over all the earth, where the world that I live in will be a good and holy place. All of that is what he's bringing with him. If that's what my life is really about, then it makes no sense, Paul is saying, to put the focus of my religious activity on whether or not I'm eating these perishable meats and vegetables or not. I eat it, it's gone. What's the big deal? What makes something a big deal in this world? What makes something significant to me? What places it at a certain place in the hierarchy of values in my life? Well, how important is it? How much does it affect me? How much does it affect other people? How much does it lead to the good life for me and for other people? How much is it in keeping with reality? When we step back and look at the whole picture, the most important truths, the things that impact my life most, are the things related to what Christ is coming to bring when he comes back. So, in his picture then, I died with him, I'm living with him. And the thing he's playing with in this sense is, okay, I'm living with him, and in that sense, that relationship is a kind of a hidden, invisible one at this point, because he's not here. He's not revealed himself in his glory to the world the way he is going to. So I'm living with him, in a sense, I'm hidden away with him as well. Everything that my life is really all about has been sort of set aside with him. When he comes, then we'll see the real deal. He's the real deal, and my real life will be revealed. That's what I think what Paul is trying to get at. Okay, there are a couple of ideas in these passages that I would like to emphasize. Well, let me see how I can do it here. First of all, Paul is talking a lot about religious rituals in this section. He even mentions, let no one be your judge regarding Sabbaths. The Sabbath is one of those issues that Christians these days do not agree about, as to whether we are under obligation to keep it. I think what Paul is saying is making it very clear that Paul sees the Sabbath, along with the dietary restrictions that the Jews were under and so on, as being a part of the shadow, a part of that which God gave them to practice as a part of the Jewish religion, which was not intended to be the substance of our relationship with God. I think it was intended to point to a greater reality, and that the greater reality that it points to, as I understand the biblical picture, is it is a reminder to us. It ties back to the fact that God rested from his work. We rest from our work, but there is this ultimate rest from all our labors that is coming. That this world, in essence, we're all working real hard in this life, working towards this goal. And the goal is that final day of rest. I think that's what the Sabbath is meant to make us think about. Why did God have us rest? We work, but then there's this day where we rest. It's made us think about what is it that God's up to? What is it that he's symbolizing in that activity? Now, I do not believe that we're under obligation to keep the Sabbath anymore. Let's suppose hypothetically that I'm right. I know some of you probably do not agree with me. Let's just suppose for the sake of argument that I'm right. What does that mean about those who teach that we should keep the Sabbath? Are they all abandoning Christ? Are they not holding fast to the head and are lost because they think that we're under obligation to keep a particular ritual? Well, I wouldn't say so necessarily, because it seems to me that there are two ways to go wrong when it comes to religious activities of various sorts. One way to go wrong is to just be genuinely mistaken in what I understand God to be asking me to do. I come to God looking for His mercy. I see that I do not earn my salvation. I am no way think that I am pious or better than other people because I keep the Sabbath. But I look at the Ten Commandments and I say, I think the Ten Commandments, all ten of them, are given as an eternal, a description of eternally significant principles that never change. And so since the Sabbath is in there in the Ten Commandments, I'm going to do that. I'm going to keep it. I think God is asking me to do that. I don't think that I'm justified because I keep the Sabbath, but I'm going to be obedient. God wants me to do that, and I'm going to do it. I and that person disagree about the Sabbath at that point, and one of us is wrong. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I ought to be keeping the Sabbath, and I'm wrong not to be doing it. Each of us is doing it out of an understanding of what we think the Bible is teaching about what God has commanded us to do. I think that falls into the category of what Paul talks about, for instance, in Romans 14. Let each man be convinced in his own mind, you know, just a genuine disagreement about whether I am free or not in regards to this issue. It's better to be right, but I need to recognize that it is not, in that case, it is not a challenge to my faith that I'm wrong in that particular spot. But there is another sort of person. There is that person who is pious and good, and they know it. The reason that God accepts me is because I keep the Sabbath. I do what I'm supposed to do. And you can tell when you deal with them that they know that the reason that they're accepted by God and you're not is because they do what they're supposed to do. They keep the rules. I have met people like that. I have talked to people like that. Very strict about the Sabbath. Very loose about almost everything that the gospel has to say, but very insistent that the Sabbath be kept. If you're keeping the Sabbath, then I know you're a good guy, and if you don't, then I know you're not. That, to me, seems to fall into exactly the sort of category that we see here, the sort of people that the Colossians were listening to. People who had a mistaken idea of what the gospel was all about. And so, in fact, even though they may be naming the name of Christ in the process, they have abandoned Christ. They are not holding fast to the head because they're not listening to the teaching. They're not embracing the truth of the gospel as it really is, but they've embraced a legalistic substitute. So there are two very different ways to be mistaken in one's religious practices. And which way it goes makes all the difference. I think that's the difference between the way Paul deals with the Galatians regarding circumcision and the Romans regarding dietary practices. Both of them are religious rituals, but in one case, this group was teaching salvation depends on your doing the right rituals. And in this case, it was just a group of people who disagreed about the ethics of eating meat and vegetables. So it seems to me that there are two very different issues involved. So as we try to sort these things out, it's important that we make those kinds of distinctions so that we're not falling into the trap on either side of judging people for either practicing or not practicing the rituals that we think are essential, or on the other hand, falling into the trap of not being aware of the spiritual danger signs in someone's life, that they in fact are hugely impressed with themselves for not eating meat or whatever it might be, and that spiritual danger is involved in that. So there is a very serious issue here that Paul is talking about, but it's not a simplistic one. I think we can see when we look at all his letters that there are different ways to go wrong, and we need to be clear in our minds about what those ways are. And then one other thing that I want to emphasize from this section, I very much, Paul, see, I told you, it's a scramble if you take all of the different words, and there is a sentence in there. In my next sentence, I'm going to leave out a word. Which one is missing? Okay. The other thing that Paul emphasizes in this section, I think, is this idea of this world versus the next. Worldliness is one of the great scourges in the Bible. Why? Because the truth of the gospel is firmly, firmly set on the ultimate outcome of human life. God is coming to judge. God is coming to restore. God is coming to redeem, to glorify. That's the truth of human life. You can believe it or not, but it's going to happen. The choices you make now are choices about where your eternal destiny is going to be spent. What happens to me? Do I arrive at good or not? Now is the time when that issue is being sorted out. That is fundamental to the gospel. Christianity is a pie-in-the-sky religion, I have often said. It is. It is saying there is a good out there to be had. Embrace it now while you can, before it's too late. Because it is everything. It is everything. If you lose it, you have nothing. If you lose everything else but gain it, you have everything. So, I mean, what is in your best interests? Now is the time to make that decision. Obviously, those who don't believe in God at all have no choice but to be worldly in their perspective. They look around at this world, how can I make it work now? But what's significant in this passage is that Paul is saying that religious people can be worldly as well. I mean, you know, this is all about God. I'm fasting for God. I'm eating vegetables only for God. I'm keeping Sabbaths for God. But there's a worldliness about it. It's focused on now. In essence, I'm thinking about the gains that I can make now. Today, I can behave myself in a certain way, show my piety, gain the rewards that come from being a pious person. All of that is my reward today. It's not really focused on the fundamental and real meaning of life, which, if I were to focus on what's really going on, come to know who God is, what His real values are, what He has come to bring about in the world, then the choices I make now would start to look different. They would have a real difference to them because the foundation on which they're built is different. Now, how would they look different? That's what we'll start talking about next time, because Paul is going to start his exhortation about how they ought to be living in the light of this truth in the verses that are coming up. But his perspective is that in one sense, what's out there and coming is everything. You lose sight of that now and you're a fool. If you remember it and keep it in your sights now, then you will be turned around the right direction. You're headed the right direction, and the choices you make will be about that goal, and they will be the right choices. I am firmly convinced, as much as it might seem strange to say, that much of the church today is fundamentally worldly. And I don't mean that they go to movies and they play cards and stuff like that, because actually, I go to movies and play cards if you want to know the truth about it. So, take it. You can put that in your pipe and smoke it, but I know, of course, you don't smoke, because that's not good. So, that's not what I mean. That's not the kind of worldliness I'm talking about. I'm talking about exactly the kind of worldliness that Paul is getting at here. I'm talking about God, but I'm thinking about now. God becomes a way for me to transform my existence now. I'm looking for the bennies now in some way or another. I enjoy the satisfactions now of disciplining myself religiously or whatever it might be. The church today is filled with a lot of worldliness in that sense. We have gotten afraid to say that the point of our existence is the hope that is before us. This book is filled with talk about our hope. every letter written in the New Testament, just about, you'd be hard put to find one that does not emphasize our hope, ultimately, as what our lives are about. If we do not emphasize that, we lose sight of what's going on. If I hammer on you, do this, do this, do this, maybe I can change your behavior, but I haven't changed your thinking. If I tell you the purpose and meaning of life is found in what Christ is bringing, and I convince you that that's true, and you understand what it is he's bringing, and the implications of that, you come to think about it and live with it, and day by day, year by year, you see more and more what the implications of that are for your life, then I have changed your behavior. But I have changed it in a way that is more profound, because it's built on understanding. And I don't have to tell you what to do when a new situation comes along. You don't have to come running to me and say, Ron, you didn't tell us what to do here. Because you understand the foundations on which you're building. The reality hasn't changed. The focus of your life hasn't changed. And in this new situation, then, what does that tell me is at the heart of things? We'll see how this plays itself out in practical terms as we move into some of the later verses. But what I think is essential for us to understand is that the biblical model is, I come to understand, and that understanding is very much focused on the hope before me. And in understanding and being focused on that hope, my life today is transformed. That's the biblical picture. There isn't another one. And if you go another road, you're walking away from the only road to life that there is. Okay, so let's take a few minutes for whatever questions and comments you might have for Jack. No, I guess I'll say something. I mean, I've been talking up to now. I might as well keep going on.
It seems to me that there's a pretty pervasive misapplication of sections like this. I think they have to do some severe gymnastics and blinders mm-hmm. and stuff, mm-hmm. but seems right. like there's a lot of success at that.
Yeah.
And my experience has been is seeing people take a verse like focus on the things above, mm-hmm. set your heart on the mm-hmm. kingdom to come, as an excuse to or escape from learning wisdom in this life. They right. miss the point of verse 5. They do things with verse 5,
right.
but they miss the point of therefore live your life out this
right.
way. And it is so pervasive that it's just really makes it really difficult in the Christian community to try to enter into your own struggle, because you have all sorts of people who, when you are choosing to say, you know, I've been hiding from this reality, and I need to enter into trying to not hide so much. Maybe it's something in the past that you have really kind of put in a box somewhere, or maybe it's something in a current relationship you have. They say, set your mind on things above, and they throw not billboard, but bumper sticker, little right. slogans. You're just supposed to say these and think about them as if the goodness out there has really no connection to struggling to learn about goodness here.
Right.
And it's just so impactful and so damaging and hurtful. And it amazes me how they come up with that
right.
in one sense.
Right.
In another sense, you're always looking for an out, and we're really creative. But I just was kind of really impacted by that, because these kind of verses bring up a big emotional response for me because of how they've been used
right.
Towards me
yeah.
and others.
Well, I very much agree with you. I think absolutely these, just what you said, and I agree with what you said. And in fact, when I say, when I use language like Christianity is a pie-in-the-sky religion, I mean that to sort of shock people and bring us back to the fact that our focus is supposed to be on the hope of the gospel. But there is a kind of, what people sometimes object to when they talk about pie-in-the-sky religion is kind of captured by that phrase, he's so heavenly-minded, he's no earthly good, you know, that kind of thing. There is a reality like that, which is, I think, related very much to what you're talking about. I'm the sort of vague, golden, hazy picture of bliss someday as a thing to hide behind without dealing with the implications of the truth for where I'm living right now. And absolutely that happens. And I don't mean that that should happen at all. In fact, constantly, you know, when we were looking in 1 Peter a couple years ago or whenever it was, I was trying to point out there that Peter is very strong in his language about fix your hope completely on the grace to be revealed to you at the revelation of Christ and that sort of thing. And yet, connected right with that is his admonition concerning holiness of life. And in 2 Peter, we see that same thing. We're looking for the new heavens and earth where righteousness dwells. But because we know that this world is going to be destroyed, he said, what sort of people should you be? How should you be living? So the biblical picture is, I come back to today by going through the doorway of here's what my tomorrow is all about. Here are the choices I'm making about tomorrow. To just sort of have a hazy sort of, oh, one day everything will be great in heaven or something like that is really, I think, could be an actual refusal to embrace the gospel at all, because I'm not really dealing with the reality of sin. I mean, what was the cross all about? Why did that have to happen? And if heaven is the whole point, then what is God doing now? Why didn't he just wrap this thing up? Why do I have to go through all of this stuff? I am living in this world. What's the point of it? What does he want me to do while I'm here? He wants to spend all my time forgetting that I'm here and just thinking about golden streets or something. That doesn't make sense. And then my other comment would be, part of the problem is that we're just, and I despair, I don't know what to say or what to do when it comes to this sort of thing, but I'm seeing as I go through Colossians how easy it is to just pull out verses like that. So, you know, well, here's, you know, set your mind on things above. But that verse is in a context. From beginning to end, there is a focus to what Paul is saying. You can see what the ideas are he has on his mind. And that's what I'm trying to help. I don't know how good a job I'm doing, but I'm trying to help you see the connection, the themes that are running through this, the ideas that tie all this together. If you don't look at that, then you will misunderstand it. I mean, we can take the Bible and make it say anything if we don't let the flow of thought tell us what is the subject here? What are we talking about? And man, oh man, oh man, oh man. It's an epidemic out there. I mean, even among those, you know, I would look to with admiration and respect and feel like I have a lot to learn from them as mature believers. It is hard to find people among that community that can deal with the Bible. Even people like that, that I think genuinely they're on solid ground and they're really to be admired and I see them as my brother or sister, you know, that there's something solid there. And yet I cringe when I hear them talk about the Bible, because we've lost sight of the fact that this is writing that's intended to communicate. I mean, this was Paul writing to the Colossians, one sentence after another. Gee, I have a set of ideas in my head. I think I'll start writing them down in a meaningful way. And we go mining, you know, oh, I got this verse over here and this verse over here. It's deadly. I mean, you know, you guys, I know, this is my, you know, I pound the pulpit, this is my soapbox I get on. But the fact is that Don't you think there's a certain richness that comes? I mean, what I'm teaching is not the greatest teaching that you've ever heard in the world, especially on days when I can hardly get my sentences out. But the fact is that there's some substance to this. Not to me, but to... There's some breadth to this. There's something to chew on. There's something to get a hold of. Well, where did that come from? If it comes from anywhere, it comes from the fact that what we're trying to do here is to put together Paul's ideas as he was thinking them, to see it, the whole picture. Because when you do that, you start to see the coherence of it, the richness of it, the focus of it. You know, what's the big idea, Paul? Well, if you pay attention to his argument, the big idea starts to emerge. And if you do that with enough books in the Bible, pretty soon the big idea of the whole book starts to emerge. And if you don't do that, you just have a lot of little ideas, some of which are not true, and some of which are out of context, and all of which are sort of scattered and ultimately have the potential to be anything from irrelevant to damaging. Because they're just these little snippets of things. So that's what happens in the kind of scenario you're describing is, it says, set your mind on the things above and not on the things of the earth. So, you know, you're asking me to deal with my attitude towards this person. That's a thing of this earth. I'm not going to set my mind on that. Well, I can say that, but I'm an idiot. I mean, that's not what Paul meant. Can I go to Paul and say, Paul, see, you told me. I mean, here were people who were trying to get my attention and say, you needed to think about this issue in your life. But I fought him off, Paul. I thought about the things above and not the things on earth. I don't think he's going to be pleased. I really don't think that's what he had in mind. So, I mean, if you read the rest of the letter, he certainly doesn't seem to be advocating a life with your head in the sand. That's just not what he wants. So I must be wrong. If I think that that's what he meant there, I must be wrong. And how did I get wrong? Well, part of how I got wrong is I wasn't paying any attention. I mean, I guarantee you, you grab some letter of yours or some letter that somebody else wrote you and you start pulling sentences out of it and using them for whatever you want, you can make those letters say anything you want. But don't do it. Okay. We're running out of time, and I've seen three hands. What am I going to do? Yeah, that's a very good point.
Well, in some ways, I understand, too, that... Well, I love being here. This is so good. But anyway, you know, I'm being forward here and kind of taking some of your time. But what you're talking about today actually really brings up a big question for me, and I think for Jeannie and I, about... What is it we're really longing for in the fact that we don't have a church right now? And that we've lived roughly the last 4 years we found some community, but... kind of getting at what you were saying, I think for me I just want to really pay attention to the fact that the reason I ought not to be desperate to find a church or really long to find a church is so that I create that practice or that religious habit that I can either over-invest in or cling to and therefore convince myself that I'm on the right track. Because it occurs to me that, and the attitude that I even get, we work in a Christian environment, the theater is based on Christians, and we get this thing about, you do theater 7 days a week often, and there's a lot of resistance there to working on Sundays. And that somehow your soul is somewhat in peril if you're not in the habit of doing something like that. And I guess what is just kind of dawning on me is actually I'm in church a lot of the time in my life, and that my life presents a lot of opportunities for me to look at the things to come through my life experience, and that I'd like to take that into church. And I think that what happens here is that people bring the week that they've lived to church and try and wrestle with that rather than stringing church Sunday to church Sunday and trying to leap over the week to get to the next Sunday. And And it occurs to me, too, that the thing is that in our lives, there's this, in our lives and in our relationship to God, there's this wildness. There's a real lack of control, lack of compartmentalization, lack of linear experience to what is happening to us in our day-to-day lives. That is our relationship to God and the way He is treating us. And I experience a lot of other Christians as people that use religious practices to try and get God into that box or into that framework that makes sense out of either what's happening to them or is an anesthetic to what's happening to them. So I guess I just wanted to say that I'm really glad to get to be here because this is a church community, but the reason that I ought to want to be in a church community is not to arm myself necessarily against what I have to go and experience outside the door in the sense that I'm impervious to it or I can't be impacted by it.
Right. What we ought to care about is the truth of the gospel. I ought to care about hearing it, reminding myself of it, thinking about it. I ought to care about talking about it with other people. I ought to care about other people who share my faith and my belief that the focus of life is what we've been saying here that it is. I mean, those are the things that are of fundamental importance. And if you have an opportunity to do that with anyone along the way, if there are any believers where you have the opportunity to live together, to be believers together, to remind each other of the truth together, then that's what we're shooting for. And I think you're right. Church as a religious obligation is just one more game to play. But church as a place where we come because we care about these things and we are looking for an opportunity to be with other people who care about these things, that I want to be reminded about what's true, armed against the weak in the other sense, armed in the sense that I want to be reminded of what's true so that as I'm living that week, not as I'm hiding from it, but as I'm living it, I know what it is that my life is about. I have been reminded what the focus of my life is about because it is so easy for me to forget. That's central, and I get it where I can. If I can't find a large group of people that are interested in that, then I find a small group of people who are interested in that. And if I can't find anybody, then I use a telephone and I get on the internet and I listen to tapes. And on sale. Well, we're really late. I'm sorry, but we need to have pity on the folks who've got the kids.